Well, please come with me to Matthew chapter 13, and we're in this chapter of parables, a number of different parables, and they all begin, "The kingdom of heaven is like," because they're parables concerning the kingdom of heaven. And we've come to the parable of the leaven. So Matthew 13 and verse 33, "The kingdom of," another parable he spoke to them, "The kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal till it was all leavened." Now, if you remember, Matthew's writing his gospel predominantly to Jews, and his theme in the gospel is the kingdom of heaven. That's why he's writing it. He's writing about the kingdom of heaven because the Jews in their minds have very clear ideas about the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven, of course, is where God reigns. It's where his will is done. And the Jews were waiting for the kingdom of heaven to come. They were waiting for the reign of God to break in upon the earth. There was to be a Jewish sort of greeting, may God set up his kingdom in your lifetime. It's the thing they were all longing for, hoping for, waiting for. And of course, when Christ comes into the world, they're positively bursting with expectation that the kingdom of heaven has now come. And they believe that when the kingdom of heaven would come, it would be very obvious, very clear. It would be the end. I've drawn this lots of times, so I hope it's familiar. There's the old age is dominated by the curse, by death, by suffering, by tears, by all the things that living in a cursed world is. That's the old age. And they said that when the kingdom of heaven comes, when the reign of God breaks in, it'll be obvious. It'll be the end of the old age and the beginning of a glorious new age. As they looked at the kaleidoscope of images in the Old Testament, they saw that new age as the end of death, a banquet for the nations, the punishment of the wicked, a restored king ruling over Israel, the restoration of their territory and all that goes with it, and many other things as well. But they all agreed that when the kingdom of heaven comes, it'll be cosmic, explosive, public. No one will have any doubt at all that the reign of God has broken in upon the earth, said the Jews. But of course, that's not how it comes. And what we've seen and what Matthew is trying to get over to the Jews is actually when the kingdom of heaven comes, the old age just carries on. So there's the kingdom of heaven breaking in, and the new age begins, but it begins while the old age is still here. The two ages overlap. Now, eventually, of course, the old age will end, and the new age will go on for eternity. But Matthew was showing them that actually they overlap, and that the coming of the kingdom is progressive. It's not crash, bang, wallop. And if you remember, that's that sort of theological expression which people have had, the already but not yet. It's already here, but it's not yet here. It's begun, but it's not yet being consummated. We pray in the Lord's Prayer, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And God's kingdom is coming. And we pray, "Your kingdom come," and it is coming. And we continue to pray, "Your kingdom come," until that day when the kingdom is consummated. It's the already but not yet. And that's shocking to the Jews. It's against their programming. There's a teaching that's been handed down generation after generation after generation. When you come to the suffering parts of the Old Testament, well, that's talking about suffering Israel. The idea of a suffering Messiah is unthinkable. But all those passages which speak of the glory and the coming of the kingdom, which are all true, they see that as coming all together and at once. So what Matthew is doing is writing to resolve this tension in the Jewish mind between what they're expecting and how it's actually going to be fulfilled. And he does that all the way through, and everything is consistent with that, what he's trying to get over. And so when we come to chapter 13, we've got all these parables, and Jesus is saying, this is what it looks like when God takes charge. This is what happens when the reign of God breaks in. If you understand the parables, you'll understand that the coming of the kingdom is something that is progressive. even mundane, even apparently ordinary, just like a parable, just like a sower sowing the seed. And actually, when the kingdom comes, it can be resisted, just like three types of ground which resist the seed. So he's teaching them what the reign of God looks like through these parables. This is what happens when God starts to reign upon the earth. This is what we should expect when heaven breaks out upon the earth. Hence, every parable begins, the kingdom of heaven is like. And therefore, through his parables, Jesus is breaking the mold, isn't he? We all have expectations. We all have things that are handed on to us from the previous generation. In the Christian world, we do. And we all have pigeonholes. And the pigeonholes get handed on from one generation to the next about this is the way that it is. I don't know about you, I sometimes spend my life trying to punch my way out of pigeonholes. Sorry, don't worry, this isn't a rant, but I got a phone call this morning. And anyone heard of Steve Ham, brother of Ken Ham, Answers in Genesis? Well, Steve Ham's going to be in London in August. I got a phone call, would we like to have Steve Ham? And would we like to arrange a meeting? Maybe a sort of, I don't know, something on a Friday or a Saturday. So I said, yeah, you know, send through the details. I won't be around, but we can email around, and if you want to set up a meeting, that's fine. Anyway, Answers in Genesis. He thought he'd better ask me. He said, well, do you believe in a young earth? He said to me. So I said what I believed in. And he said, oh, okay, you're what we call an old earther. So I said, what's an old earther? And he said, well, someone who believes in an old earth, but also in Adam and Eve. I said, well, that's not what I've said. He said, oh, you believe in 6 days of creation? I said, yes. I said, I believe that on the sixth day God made Adam and Eve. So he said, what about death? Did that exist before Adam? I said, no, because sin came into the world through Adam. And what had thrown him was that I said that I believe in Genesis 5, when it says all flesh was corrupted, that you had in that time scale, however it was done, a massive amount of evolution leading to all the grotesque creatures that you find in the fossil record. So we have all these dinosaurs, these grotesque lizards. I said, I don't believe God made dinosaurs because they're grotesque. They're ugly. God wouldn't look at a dinosaur and say it is good. So the serpent kind was more cursed than the others, and you get this rapid evolution when all flesh was corrupted. It's a rapid evolution of this serpent kind leading to all these grotesque monsters, and obviously they're eradicated in the flood. So we had a bit more of a discussion. And I realized what had happened was that because what I said was not in that pigeonhole, in spite of everything else I'd said in that pigeonhole, I got stuck into that pigeonhole. Because in the conversation, there were just two pigeonholes you go into. You either go into that pigeonhole or that pigeonhole. So if you say something that's different from that pigeonhole, it's because you belong in that pigeonhole. And I say, no, I belong in that. I'm not in that one. That's where I am. And it's interesting, isn't it? In spiritual terms, in the church, we all stick each other in pigeonholes. And I've probably done it to you. I've probably put you in a pigeonhole. And we all do it, don't we? If you don't fit in there, you must fit in there. And you say, well, I don't fit in there. Although if you must fit in there. No, maybe things are more nuanced. Maybe actually there's a bigger picture. Maybe actually what we've been handed on to be put in a pigeonhole isn't the way things really are. And we all do it, don't we? We all pigeonhole. I think I find myself fighting my way out of pigeonholes that I get stuck in. And when we come to this, the parables and the whole thing of Matthew saying, he's trying to get away from the pigeonhole. The Jews have a pigeonhole. Everything goes into that. Everything's got to fit that frame. And Matthew's saying, no. It's actually like this. And the parables here are dealing with that box mindset, that pigeonhole mindset. Things are much more nuanced. Okay, I could really rant about that, but I'm not. Because I think Reformed people and Reformed churches are terrible in that respect. There are all sorts of pigeonhole shibboleths that get handed down. Anyway, there we go. Let's have a look at the parable. So Matthew 13, verse 33, parable of the leaven. Let's read it again. Another parable he spoke to them. The kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal until it was leavened. Okay, let's have a look at the clues. And then when we've had a look at the clues, we'll see if we can together work out what the parable's saying. Okay? So the clues. Well, let's ask, what's leaven?
Yeast.
So it's a yeast culture. So a woman takes a yeast culture and hides it in flour. Now, we're in a Jewish world. A yeast culture, we're told she actually takes leaven, so it's yeast. A Jewish woman would only use new yeast once a year. If you remember, when it comes to the Passover feast, they have to get rid of all the old leaven. It's to be completely removed. Then they have a seven-day feast of unleavened bread. Then new leaven comes in. So at the beginning of their sort of ceremonial year, it's new leaven. So this woman is not introducing fermented dough. She's actually putting in new leaven, something brand new. It's a new yeast culture. It's the start of something. And we're told she hid it in three measures of flour or meal. Now, if you go and have a look at what the measure does, in the margin of mine, it says the same as the Hebrew seer, approximately 2 pecks in all. So that's what 3 measures is, 2 pecks. So I hope you're all clear about that. That throws a great deal of light on it. Looking up elsewhere, it is about 50 kilos. Or if you're still working in imperial measurements, it's about 100 weight. It's huge, isn't it? It's a lot of flour. 50 kilos of flour is a lot. You've got enough there to feed 150 people. Okay? So what she's doing, she's taking something that's new, a new, brand new yeast culture, and she's putting it in a huge amount of flour, very large quantity of flour. When we read there leaven, I know elsewhere leaven is spoken of it with negative connotations. Beware the leaven of the Pharisees. When Paul writes the Corinthians about dealing with sin in the church, he says, purge out the old leaven. It can be used in that context, but here we're being told that that's not to be in our mind. It's not something that's evil, is it? Because it's saying the kingdom of heaven is like leaven. So it's a very positive thing. Okay? So, something new, hidden in the flour, and when you put it in, a huge amount of flour, you put in, and eventually the whole amount is leavened. Okay? So what thoughts does that conjure up? I'm not asking necessarily for thoughts in terms of the spiritual application, but what in the parable, what particular thoughts come to mind? What's it emphasizing?
The infectious nature of the yeast.
Okay, yeah, it's infectious nature. Do you want to add a bit more to that? Go on.
Well, just that everything doesn't keep itself.
So change. Neil, you were saying something? Okay, so transformation, yeah? So that's very key to it, isn't it? Transformation. Other thoughts that come out?
We don't know the proportion of yeast, do we? But I'm assuming it was less than...
And what's the word that's used? What does she do?
Hides.
She hides, doesn't she? So what does that tell you? It's concealed, it's small, you wouldn't even know it was there, would you? So, she hides, it's small, it's concealed. Okay, what else is going on?
The result is comprehensive, all
that. Yep, so the transformation is complete. It affects everything all the way through, nothing is left untouched. Yes. So it's small enough to be hidden. So it's small enough to be hidden, isn't it? And yet at the end of it, everything's been changed by it. So at the end of it, it's impossible not to see the change, isn't it? At the start, you wouldn't know it was there. At the end, everyone knows it's there. OK? Okay? What else is going on? Why choose something like yeast? What's the message about yeast? Sorry, that's an unfair question, isn't it? Because that is the message about yeast. What is yeast? What sort of stuff is it? What does it come from? What is it?
It's alive.
It's alive. Okay, so that's very significant, isn't it? It's alive. It's alive. It's something living. It's not mechanical. You haven't wound something up. You haven't put a battery in. It's something that is alive. It has a life of its own. And once you set it up, it's off. There's life. It permeates. There's life. It's alive. It permeates. And there's one final, there's one perhaps big obvious final thought, which we mentioned about what does a Jewish woman do? What's the significance about what she's doing? She's preparing for the future. But what is it about, if you read, for example, like we said, the new culture comes in when she's purged out the old. The significance is it's new. Okay, she's not putting in fermented dough. She's not putting in dough that's already sort of on the go and putting that in with her bread like you can with, what's it called? There's a thing where you just keep sourdough. Yeah, she's not doing a sourdough thing. What she's doing is actually saying, I've got completely brand new yeast. I'm introducing a new yeast culture. Okay, now if I can just sort of summarize those into four words. She hid. Second thing to say, what have I done? Transformation. The third thing to say, so I want to get in the right order. New. And the fourth thing is, it's alive. Okay, that's just what the parable is telling you. Okay, it's hidden because you wouldn't even know it was there. It's imperceptible. It transforms because you have a great quantity of flour. There's a hidden power at work, and it's all affected by the end. It's new. It's something radical. It comes from the outside, and it changes everything. It's not more of the same. It's not the old leaven. It's new. And the fourth thing to say, it's alive. It's organic. Once you start it, you can't stop it. It doesn't run out of batteries. There's a living force behind the transformation. I remember when we used to do biology with year nines, we used to look at the best conditions for getting bread to, getting dough to expand for the fermentation process. And you have different temperatures and different this and that. And if you get the conditions which are right, and you get it all set up, and these, 14-year-old lads wander in, dough and yeast is not going to be terribly exciting, is it? You wouldn't think. But they will go, oh, look at that, sir. Because you put a little bit of flour, a little bit of yeast, and if you get the conditions right, it'd be bubbling over the top and pouring out, and it would just be out of all proportion to what you thought was there in the first place. Quite a dramatic effect. Okay. Let's ask some questions then. Let's look at the first two words, right? It's hid and it leads to transformation. How does that deal with the disparity in the Jewish mind between what they're expecting and how it's fulfilled? They're expecting this crash, bang, wallop, the kingdom to come, but actually how it actually comes in. How do these first two words explain the reign of God?
There's a period of time involved between the hiding and the transformation.
Yes. And in fact, if you were a Jew and you say, I can't see the kingdom, where is it? You might say, well, of course, it's hidden. That's why you can't see it. You're expecting to see things that you can't see because it's hidden. But actually, if you leave it long enough, what will it do? Ultimately, the kingdom. It'll grow, and ultimately what will you get? It'll change everything, won't it? They're saying, I'm expecting to see everything change now. The parable says, no, it'll be hidden, unseen, but ultimately everyone will see it because it'll transform everything. Does that make sense? Yeah? Then you've got these two other words, new and alive. Let's ask a different question. What's the connection between new and alive with Jesus? Think about in terms of what we said about yeast. That's right, so...
It's like the old yeast which was thrown away completely, completely new yeast, Christ completely threw away the old covenant and brought in the new covenant.
Yep, so here's something completely new. Christ comes in, he's not coming to patch up the old. And where does he come from? He comes from out of this world, doesn't he? When this woman hides her yeast in the flour, she's not taking some old yeast and shoving it in, is she? She's taking a completely new culture, because that's what the Jews used to do. You can read about it in Deuteronomy and so on. So he comes from outside this world, into this world, and changes everything. What about the alive bit? Or the life bit, maybe that's a better way of saying it. He is the life, yeah. So just again relating it to the fact of what yeast does to the flour. It's not a mechanical thing, is it? You don't wind up the yeast and put it in there and then the battery runs down or it stops doing it. It once it gets going, what's the implication when thinking about Christ? In terms of life.
Could say thought out.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
So yeah. Although it may seem very random to us,
yes.
Very slow,
yes.
Yet Christ knows what is happening, it is in control and directing everything.
Yes, yes. Yes, indeed, absolutely. So... behind it, behind what's going on, is the very life of God himself. The very plan of God. The very life of Christ. As you say, David, it's not something that's a sort of, you know, in that sense, it is unstoppable. It will conquer. You can't stop it because the life of God is in this. Makes it wonderful, doesn't it?
could one go as far as to... Go on.
Yes.
To really rejoice in the fact that Christ is very much alive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why you have that the resurrection is that pivotal point, isn't it? Because everything flows from that. If there's no resurrection, then it is a dead Christ, and a dead Christ changes nothing. Here, the resurrection life of Christ is in the kingdom.
With the unleashing of the Spirit, the work of the Spirit throughout the ages, it's interesting that it says...
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. The very life of God is at work in the kingdom. Both at work in individual believers, at work in the church, at work in the world. The Spirit of God is transforming everything. Well, let's try and put it all together into some sort of cohesive narrative, okay? We'll cut lots of corners. But this is what we're saying, isn't it? We're saying God's Son, he comes from heaven into this world. Okay? So he comes from outside this world into this world. It's something new, like the leaven being introduced. The world he comes into is a world under the curse. God cursed it. It's a world that's dead or dying. I said that's a better word. But well, it's a world that's dying. Or it's a world perhaps that's under the reign of death. Everything in this world dies. So Christ comes. He comes from the outside. His coming is radical. And his coming, of course, is like leaven. But then you get to the hidden bit. Because his coming into the world is hidden, isn't it? I mean, how many people knew he was born at Bethlehem? I mean, you probably count it on one hand. More than one hand, several hands, but not many hands. There were the shepherds, and they go and spread the report. But actually, not many other people, is it? Obviously, the wise men turn up. We don't know how many of them there were, but hardly anyone knows what's really going on, do they? How many people knew that this little child in Egypt was the Son of God? Hardly anybody. Just Mary and Joseph. No one noticed this little boy running around. And when they saw the carpenter's son at Nazareth, who expected anything to come from the carpenter's son? Nobody. He was just the carpenter's son. And even when he was a carpenter himself, Mark 6, he's just the carpenter. And of course, when he begins his ministry, just a chapter before, Jesus keeps his identity hidden, doesn't he? We read in Matthew 12, verse 15, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all, yet he warned them not to make him known. So he himself said, I want to remain hidden. And in fact, Matthew quotes from Isaiah, and it says, he will not quarrel nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. He's not shouting, I'm the Messiah, come to me, in that sense. He'll be the hidden Messiah. And on the cross, Calvin calls Jesus the hidden Christ on the cross. Why is he hidden on the cross?
Because if you were, let's say, part of the crowd, it wouldn't have looked Jesus was God, the Son of God,
etc.
Just looked like a common criminal.
That's right. If you said to people, look, that is the maker of the world on that tree. That is the long-awaited Christ on the tree. That is the King on the tree. No one looked less like the King. No one looked less like the Christ. No one looked less like the maker of the world, did they? I mean, he's completely unrecognizable. Sorry, Pete, go on. He's completely hidden. Yeah, that's absolutely. The sun's blotted out. He's hidden. As someone said, the only person who recognizes him that day for who he is who? The centurion. Yes, sorry. Yes, the centurion. The thief on the cross. Yes. I mean, someone says the youngest believer in the world is the only one who recognizes him for who he is. It's an interesting thought, isn't it? Because he actually sees for who he is. And obviously the centurion after that. But he's completely unrecognized, isn't he? Because his identity is hidden. He's hidden beneath layer upon layer of humiliation and grief and sorrow. And, of course, ultimately, he's hidden beneath the layer of death, isn't it? Nothing looks less like God, less like the Christ, than a dead body on a tree. These are extraordinary things, aren't they? And you can see why the Jews stumble over it. You can see why it's so shocking for them. Because you say, this is your Messiah. This is the one you've been waiting for. And actually, there he is, dying a cursed death. He's nailed to a tree, even abandoned by God. You know, sometimes we can be, I don't mean being harsh on the Jews, but sometimes we don't actually see the way they're thinking. But if you've been conditioned generation after generation, this is the way it's going to happen. God says, they deserve a book, if I'm polite. They need a book to explain just why it is as it is, because of how different it is from what they expect. Okay, he's the hidden Christ. But of course, in that death, what he's doing is dealing with the curse, isn't he? He takes a body that's made of the cursed earth. He dies in it. He becomes the focus of the curse. They crown him with thorns because the Father crowns him with the curse. So he comes into a cursed earth with a body made of cursed earth. He becomes the focus of the curse. And so by doing that, he exhausts the curse. The curse sort of pours in on him and exhausts the curse. He dies. 3 days later, he's risen. He now has new life. He ascends into heaven. He's crowned. And then from his throne, the transformation begins. I mean, it's been there beforehand, but it now becomes very obviously, doesn't it? The first transformation is the day of Pentecost. 3,000 converted. They see what they didn't see before. And it's dramatic. And as you follow on, you realize that you know, as it says, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Christ was rejected, has now become the chief cornerstone, and God is building from that foundation. He's building a new universe. He's building a new creation. The first thing that's going to be rebuilt, the first thing that's going to be transformed, is the church. So he's building a new temple. But ultimately, that growing out, that building out from the chief cornerstone, will actually ultimately cover the whole universe. Or another way of thinking about it is if Christ is the head, then that resurrection life will go into the whole of his body, the church. And the kingdom of heaven will actually, in the end, transform all. You basically sound like what you're saying, for that one resurrection, the whole universe will be resurrected. From that one resurrection, leaven, new, but hidden, you can't see it, his identity concealed. From that one thing will come the transformation of everything. Till eventually the boundaries of the kingdom will be coextensive with the universe. Wherever you are in the new universe, you will be in the kingdom of heaven. You'll be directly in the reign of God, under the reign of God. The tabernacle of God will now be with men. Okay? And heaven and earth will be united again, the curse will be swept away, everything will be transformed. And of course it's unstoppable, isn't it? Because behind it all is the life of God. And you can't kill the life of God. I mean, we get glimpses of it, don't we? You know, you see countries where the church is terribly persecuted. But you can't kill it. The more they attack it, the more it grows. Because what they're trying to attack and kill is the life of God. And you can't kill the life of God. So the more you attack the kingdom, the faster the kingdom grows. Like in Iran. Wonderful. All this persecution going on, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So, praise God, the very life of God is behind it. Does that all make sense? Yeah? Okay, let's make some time sticking on, so we make some brief applications, but hopefully encouraging applications. The first thing to say is, obviously, God's work is often hidden. It begins in unseen ways. So, Christian friends, we must never be discouraged by small beginnings. Sometimes they're so small you don't even know they're there. They're hidden, they're concealed. You know, who knows, we've got St. Margaret's Fair. Who knows whether something very small will take place on St. Margaret's Fair. So small that no one ever noticed, no one ever noticed or saw it happened. But who knows what God might do with it. And by the same token, don't be afraid, brothers and sisters, to work in a hidden way. Don't be afraid to work as a carpenter in Nazareth, where no one's going to notice you. Don't be afraid of years of obscurity. Maybe you're unrecognized by your own generation. Maybe at the end you're despised, just like Christ. Don't be afraid to be a nobody. Who knows where God might hide you? He hides his people, doesn't he? In places. And you never know what was going on until later on things begin to happen and change. So, as someone said, give up all your ambitions save one, which is to live to the glory of God. Don't be ambitious for anything except the glory of God. As soon as you're not being ambitious for other things, it gets in the way, doesn't it? Be ambitious for the glory of God, and God can hide you anywhere and do wonderful things. Second thing to say is transformation. It's a transformation, but it doesn't happen all at once, is it? It's hidden, it takes time for the dough to rise, and so on. So don't lose heart if you're not yet perfect. Because it's a transforming work that's going on inside us. Okay? So sin does remain. I do have besetting sins. There are things of which we're ashamed. There are things that break our hearts. Don't be discouraged if you're not yet what you long to be. It will happen. It just takes time. And therefore we must be patient with each other, mustn't we? Because all of us are works in progress. All of us are in the process of being transformed. Don't look at your brothers and sisters and saying, well, look, they should be like this, 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 and this. Yes, one day they will be like this. The fact they're not like this at the moment is not because God's abandoned them, or because they're rubbish, useless Christians. It's because they're in the process of the transformation. Some things will have changed very quickly, other things will change very slowly. But there is a transformation. They're not what they once were, even if they're not yet what they will be. And therefore, we have to be patient with the life of the church, don't we? There's always somebody spoiling the life of the church because I spoil the life of the church because I'm still a work in progress. We all spoil the life of the church because we're all sinners. So we must be patient with each other, kind to each other, long-suffering, tender, gentle, because transformation takes time. You can think of the Church of Jesus Christ today. We understand the gospel much more clearly than they did 1,000 years ago. There are many things that in our own understanding or in terms of the size of the church, it's taken 2,000 years to get here. Things don't always happen very quickly. They take time. We must be patient. We must be patient with one another. But it is transformation. So think of the impact of one godly life. God may hide you in a community, he may hide you in a workplace, he may hide you in a family. The impact of one godly, holy life lived for Christ is out of all proportion to what you think is there. Doesn't look much, but actually God hides it and the transforming work is done. Or God puts a heavenly colony in West London and says, you live the life of heaven here and the transformation which may yet take place. Third thing to say is really a statement of the obvious, is that God's work is new. If it was left to the Pharisees, they'd be saying, well, of course, what you need to do, we need to have more rules, they need to be more vigorously enforced. Which would be miserable, wouldn't it? We have the resurrection life of Christ in us. We have the life of God in us. I'm now a new creation in Christ. Old things have passed away. Behold, everything's become new. Rejoice in that. Love that. Delight in that. It's wonderful. You know, don't let the world put you in a religious pigeonhole. I'm not in that pigeonhole at all. I'm new. I'm part of the new creation. I have the life of God in me. Everything's new. I don't know if he's going on, but I was chatting with Simon Smith. Some of you may know Simon. He's been converted in the last 3 to 4 months. Simon's been converted in his early 40s. We were chatting yesterday, and he just said, when I was converted, he said, everything was different. Everything was new. Now, I don't want to taught him to say that. That was just his experience. Everything is new, isn't it? Because the life of heaven has poured into us. The life of God is transforming us. Jesus has made all things new. This is a new beginning. Wonderful. And the final thing to say is that it's alive. The life of God is behind the kingdom of heaven. So a person can read 1,000 books and then they read one verse of the Bible and they're converted. A person can watch 10,000 hours of television and hear one sermon and they're converted. One holy, godly Christian in their workplace, in their community, in their family can transform that community. Because it's not them. It's the life of God that's at work. So St. Margaret's Fair, we don't lose her. Who knows what God might do? It may be hidden, you may not see it. But the life of God is there. And of course, one day, because the life of God is behind this, one day we will be as holy as God is holy. And every cell of my redeemed body will radiate with the loveliness of Christ. And one day the church, all the redeemed, all those grouchy Christians, will all shine with the beauty of Jesus. And one day the whole universe will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. So the parable of the leaven, we never ever lose heart, do we? Because what we're engaged in has the life of God pulsing through it. And you can't kill the life of God, can you? And you know that yourself sometimes. You know, sometimes you come to the end of a day and think, I can't take any more, I've had enough. Christian life's killing me. I'm worn out. I'm exhausted. I can't take any more. And just when you think you're going down, and you're never going to get up again, suddenly the life of God comes into you. And you've been renewed and revived. So it's a wonderful parable. The kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal till it was all leavened. So brothers and sisters, go away, think about these things, and then resolve to spend and be spent for Jesus, for the kingdom that will conquer all.